Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Thank you all for being with us for today's show. Couple of notes before we get going. As usual, I want to remind you that if you want to watch Political Rewind, you can do it by going to the GPB News Facebook page. We'll be right there. So we love to have you watch the show, and we get a lot of really interesting comments on the Facebook Live page. So feel free to join our conversation by sending us comments as we go through the show today. Second of all, if you don't watch us, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB if you're listening to the show by radio. And then finally, this is the week we head down to Columbus. Thursday night we'll be at the River Center with a live audience to watch the show unfold. If you want to be part of that audience, go to gpb.org/community. You can get more information on the details of the show, and you ought to register. I mean, it's free admission, but we're trying to keep track of who wants to be there, who is not going to be there. Tom Faust just whispered in my ear that tickets are going fast, so you might want to sign up as soon as possible. And as I mentioned on Friday, if you're in that audience, you will be the first to hear a big announcement about Political Rewind. We'll share it with our live audience Thursday night. Jim Galloway, you'll be at Hamilton Thursday night.
Yeah, I've got tickets. I've got tickets. I'm sorry.
Don't apologize. You cannot miss Hamilton. It's a great, great show. I'm glad you're getting to see it. That is Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him on Wednesdays and Sundays, and he oversees the Political Insider blog, part of Politically Georgia, part of myajc.com. You working on Wednesday?
Yeah, I'm looking for a topic, and it might be this Supreme Court decision. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, that's our big story, and we're going to start talking about it in just a minute. Dr. Andre Gillespie from Emory University, a political science professor, you're back with us. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, no problem.
And Heath Garrett, Republican strategist, very close advisor to Johnny Isaacson, and you're heading to Alabama. You've got a candidate over there in tomorrow's primary contest, right?
I do. It's great to be here, and the Alabama primaries are tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're heard in little east stretch of eastern Alabama, so just don't say anything that would indicate that your support, who your candidate is, because we don't want to be accused of promoting one candidate.
I appreciate your conflict rules.
And we also have with us for the first time, and really happy to welcome University of Georgia political science professor Audrey Haynes. I'm glad you could be here for the first time.
I am so glad to be here myself.
Came in from, and I want to show people, you brought each of us a T-shirt from your, tell us about the Applied Politics Program. I'm showing it to the folks on Facebook Live.
Well, the Applied Politics Program is designed to help students who want to enter into a career in politics get some additional training.
So to help them make with their career in politics?
Yes.
Or to help talk them out of that foolish decision?
Well, usually they get there when they're very goal-oriented towards being in that career. But some of them do quit midway. We've had that happen. So
it's a factory for politicians. That's what this is.
No. Lots of other areas, too.
All right. Heath has already pointed out that the big story of the morning was the Supreme Court issued its ruling on the Colorado baker who had refused, his name is Jack Phillips, he had refused to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple who came to him. The case went up through the Colorado Civil Rights Commission and through the courts, finally coming to SCOTUS, to the Supreme Court of the United States. And by a 7-2 margin, Jim, they ruled in favor of the baker. But we need to unpack this decision, because I think it's more interesting even than it might appear on the surface.
Yeah, this is kind of a typical Supreme Court decision. Let's do as little as we can to change the scope of the argument. It was a 7-2 decision. Supreme Court justices were with the majority of this. I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg and
Sonia Sotomayor were the dissents.
They were the dissents. But what it does is it doesn't address the largest question, which is, can a business discriminate against same-sex couples on the basis of religious beliefs?
Yeah, Andre, it struck me when I read the ruling that that each side is going to be able to make a case for why the court ruled in their favor. And in a couple of minutes, we're going to hear from Jeff Graham, the head of Georgia Equality, here how he views that ruling. But it does seem to offer something for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, so one, this is going to continue to be litigated. So, you know, this is just the first case. There are going to be more cases that relate to this. So the Supreme Court's decision, one, hinges on the fact that this incident happened in 2012. So this is before Obergefell, and they noted in the ruling before U.S. v. Windsor. So this is before same-sex marriage was legally recognized in the country. So where it was, and it wasn't recognized in Colorado. So there's that issue. There is the issue of how Mr. Phillips was treated when he went before the Colorado Civil Rights Division. And so during the proceedings, people made openly hostile comments about his religious faith, questioned whether or not it was true, compared it basically to Nazism. And so what the Supreme Court is ruling here is that that's a violation of his free exercise rights in the First Amendment. It does not address the issue of whether or not he could turn them down. And so, I mean, a couple of questions: if this case had, you know, if this incident had happened in 2016, you know, what would this have looked like? So this affirms the fact that people of faith have a right to express their beliefs about marriage. It doesn't exactly decide how this is going to work out in the marketplace, like what you can and can't do as a result of that.
Yeah, Audrey, here's one of the things that Justice Kennedy wrote, quote, "The neutral and respectful consideration to which Phillips," again, the baker, "was entitled was compromised here. The Civil Rights Commission's treatment of his case has some elements of a clear and impermissible hostility toward the sincere religious belief that motivated his objection." And as Andra points out, Justice Ginsburg says that one commissioner in particular, he quotes him in the ruling, crossed the line by saying to in the hearing at the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, quote, "Freedom of religion and religion has been used to justify all kinds of discrimination throughout history, whether it be slavery, whether it be the Holocaust." And I recall that quote back when this case was first being adjudicated in Colorado, that we all of us saw a red flag on that one and how the Supreme Court might take that into consideration.
No, I think a lot of people who will take the time to actually read this decision and the dissent will look at it very seriously, and hopefully it will have more of an impact on the general discourse. I agree with everything Andra said over there, and it looks to me as though multiple sides are looking at it in a very, I think, healthy way in terms of what it does, how it can be applied, and the Supreme Court itself is being very judicious, as they should be. This is a careful address of this case.
You know, Heath, of course, we've already begun getting reaction from Georgia politicians. Casey Cagle, gubernatorial candidate, has issued a statement. He said that the Supreme Court's decision, quote, "confirmed what we already knew. The Constitution protects religious exercise and expression. As governor, I'll make sure no Georgian ever has to take a case to the Supreme Court to defend their religious freedom." Well, that's how he chooses to interpret it. But it really wasn't a decision that protects a business owner from not doing business with people he chooses, who he feels are contrary to his religious beliefs or her religious beliefs.
I do think both legally and politically, this is a victory for conservatives. And we've only been able to look at this for a couple of hours. But remember, this case is not just about the specifics of discrimination regarding same-sex couples and the free enterprise system of being able to choose who you serve and who you don't serve over that action. It's also a symbolic to what I believe is a slight majority of the country. They believe that their religious beliefs are no longer protected under the First Amendment because there's an assault by general society and the media against their faith and their values. So number one, this is a big victory morally for the reinstitution of the fact that the First Amendment is about more than speech. It's about the free exercise of religion and having sincere beliefs, and that does matter. And it gets us to this complexity, right? You're not allowed to discriminate But in order to do that, you have to discriminate against somebody's religious beliefs. That's a complex constitutional point that the court's grappling with here. So it's not a clear legal victory, but by and large, it makes it more difficult for governments to do something because the way they if you're viewed as hostile to someone's faith and they've made a sincere belief there, I think this opinion will actually have some precedent.
So I understand that conservative take on this, Jim, but I'm not quite sure that that is what the Kennedy ruling says. He says in this one specific case, the commissioners seem to have a hostility toward the baker, but I don't think it addresses the larger question.
Well, and Kennedy specifically says that the decision would have been a different one had the larger question been in play. And by going for the narrow decision, they took it out. I think what this does very specifically, I'll agree with Heath on this point, is that it keeps this issue very much alive, and it's going to be very much a part of the gubernatorial race on both the Democrat and the Republican side, and it's going to have some real serious consequences in next year's session of the legislature.
And so, I mean, I think one of the important things that this sets up by saying that people of faith have a right to express an unpopular religious point of view, it does figure out, well, what does this look like kind of post-Obergefell? Right. So you can't be rude.
Reminding everyone that Obergefell is a decision that legalized gay marriage, same-sex marriage.
So it says that you have to take these things into account. This does actually curtail people's sort of public pronouncements about, you know, whether or not you get to call, how you get to sort of discuss people and frame people and characterize people in discussions. It does not answer sort of the larger question about which Phillips was trying to make, was that this wasn't just me selling a product. So if he was at Hobby Lobby, you know, selling like silk flowers, he couldn't deny service, probably wouldn't get away with, you know, denying service to silk flowers for a floral display at a same-sex wedding, because that's actually pretty generic. And what he was basically arguing was that a custom cake was my speech. You know, it's my speech that I'm selling as a commodity. And so that question has not been decided yet.
Let's do this. Audrey, let's play. I mentioned a minute ago, Jeff Graham, Georgia Equality, had a news conference about 2 hours ago now. And among the speakers was the head of Georgia Equality, Jeff Graham. And when I say that everybody's trying to come away from this, claiming a certain kind of victory, listen to what Jeff Graham had to say. I apologize, the audio is not as great as we wish it were, but I think you can hear what he says.
For the last 5 years, our legislature has spent time debating and ultimately rejecting licenses to discriminate. I hope that our legislature will look carefully at the lessons to be learned from this Supreme Court decision and will move forward in the next session to protect people of faith, but also to protect members of the LGBT community. This decision, I believe, supports the contention that all people are worthy of protection against overt discrimination. And we have a unique opportunity in Georgia to lead the country on finding that middle ground where all people can be protected.
You know, Audrey, one of the things, aside from the actual content of what he said, which I'd love to have you address, I would also say this is one of the reasons Jeff Graham has been quite successful in his role at Georgia Equality, because he does not tend to want to be a hostile force, an aggressive force. He always understands how he can position the organization so they can try to accomplish what they do. We certainly heard that there. But what did you think about what he had to say?
Well, I think it was very eloquent, and it will probably sound very positive to most of the people who are listening. And I will say this: he's smart to do that, because one of the things that we know, when you're trying to make people think more broadly or expand what they think about something that may be slightly unpopular, the worst thing that you can possibly do is tell them they're wrong, criticize them, and actually go on the attack, because our general sense is to buckle down and fight back. You know, it is it's something that's ingrained in our physiological being. I would note too that things have changed quite a bit. And we've seen things change in the Republican Party, and we've seen things change across various places in terms of LGBTQ rights. So many people do have family members who are gay. We have senators who are gay. We've had RNC chairs who have been gay. We have a lot of staffers who work on the Hill for Republican representatives who are gay.
And yet, Jim, as a couple of people have pointed out here in Georgia today, this is a state which has no civil rights law that protects individuals, say, in the gay and lesbian community, protects their rights, which is not the case in Colorado, which is why it came before the Colorado Civil Rights Commission.
Right, right. And Georgia Equality will be pushing that and I in next year's session. And I think that, again, they will probably fail. I think what's most important about Jeff Graham's remarks that we've just heard is that the thing that gives him clout in the state capitol is the alliance he's been able to form with the Georgia business community. And so the question is how the Georgia business community will look at this decision. And I don't think that there's anything in there that's going to shake them from their opposition to anti-LGBT measures that have been pushed through before.
Yeah, Heath, what do you think about that?
No, there's definitely a fine line. You can favor religious liberty legislation without it being anti-LGBT. Governor Deal had language on the table. We've seen it at the federal level that everybody operates under. I think that where this issue's gotten hijacked is this is either pro or anti-gay, and it's really not.
Could we have a conversation about that, starting with you?
Yes.
These efforts for a baker in Colorado or whatever, right, these became much more commonplace and popular since Obergefell, since gay marriage was declared by the Supreme Court, right, to be the law of the land. And these are efforts, I believe it's fair to say, by conservatives, or I'll ask you, to kind of find a back door into denying equality to gays and lesbians who are now allowed to get married.
Well, now see, I think that's where the nuance of this issue and the complication of this issue is missed upon the mainstream media and everybody else. That's how they like to characterize everything. However, I think the overwhelming majority of conservatives actually say, no, you can provide equality, and the Supreme Court can say that same-sex marriage is legal. But at the same point in time, an individual proprietor may have the right under unique circumstances, definitely not throughout commerce, but may have the right based on sincere religious beliefs to not be engaged in the marriage of a gay couple because they have sincere beliefs that are going. I think that's an important distinction, because if we're a society going to be able to have a truly multicultural society, you've got to be able to recognize the complexities of these issues and the nuances of it, and not make it an issue that it's really not.
Look, there is a line. And the Supreme Court decision that we've read, it kind of acknowledges that there's a line. You cannot, for instance, force a member of the clergy to perform a marriage that he or she doesn't approve of. It does.
Exactly.
You can't do that. Now, the question is, so where is that line? And I've got to say, in the South, that becomes a really, really sensitive issue, because public accommodation was at the heart of the civil rights movement that we're still fighting.
And obviously, I agree with that, except that just because it's a hard conversation doesn't mean it's one we shouldn't have. And there are distinctions between the issues, right?
And I don't think that this case decides any of that. So there's going to be another issue where another baker or a florist or a photographer or a wedding planner. And so it becomes this issue of sort of how intimate are people involved? Are these just kind of services for hire where you're the help and you really aren't personally involved in it, but these people kind of build their brand off of providing these really personal services and kind of becoming part of the family. And that's where this discussion, I think, is harder. I mean, I think it's probably easier if it got litigated, that if it's sort of like, you know, a generic widget shop, that they shouldn't be discriminating against anybody for any reason at all. But these people are making these really personal types of arguments, and that their businesses are more personal. And I don't think people agree on that. And so I just think, just stay tuned. There's going to be another court case.
To your point, here's exactly what Justice Kennedy wrote in his ruling. The outcome of cases like this in other circumstances must await further elaboration in the courts. all in the context of recognizing that these disputes must be resolved with tolerance, without undue disrespect to sincere religious belief, and without subjecting gay persons to indignities when they seek goods and services in an open market. And as Andra pointed out, Audrey, we've got a whole number of other cases lined up, like airplanes coming in to land at Hartsfield that eventually might make their way to the Supreme Court, where people like Justice Kennedy will be able to look at these things in a much more neutral setting.
Well, we would like to think that that would be the case, although I would think with the way politics are and the polarization that we have now, this is why people on the both sides of the issue are so concerned with elections that are going to be coming up, both the midterms and the presidential election, that politics comes in and interjects into this process. So sometimes it becomes too political as opposed to what we would really espouse, that nice, that tolerant, judicious approach that looks for that balance and that fine line, which is ultimately the goal.
Well, and Jim, to bring it around to you before we get to our break, one of the signs for this could be whether the legislature ever will, and you've already said you doubt it, take up a broad civil rights bill next session, the session after that. They've shown no appetite for doing that.
No, and you've heard Cagle and even Nathan Deal say that the general RFRA, if the state could pass a mirror image of the federal RFRA, that would be sufficient, except that the federal law does recognize some classes that you are not allowed to discriminate against.
And so one of the interesting things is I was just following this on SCOTUS blog today in terms of looking at protected classes. So race and gender are definitely protected classes. The Supreme Court's been ruling on those for decades. The Second Circuit, you know, has said sexual orientation is a protected class, and the Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal on that particular case. So, I mean, you know, so as people are looking at sort of these this narrow band of services, there also has going to be this larger legal debate about sort of, you know, whether or not LGBT status is a protected class.
Okay, we got to get to a break. Before we do, David Futral is on Facebook Live. He says, as a Republican, I support the rights of the LGBT community and people of faith to uphold their deeply religious beliefs. We should be able to find, or we can find, a middle ground for both sides. Marionette Alan Audeferin, I hope I'm saying that right, says the problem is that this line will be pushed toward other issues. I'm not. Send us another note telling us what you think those other issues might be. Christina Randall Turner says concerned about the Supreme Court 7-2 decision, but more concerned about 45's, President Trump's, claim he can pardon himself. Well, maybe we'll find time for that. You are watching on Facebook Live from Tybee Island, from Augusta, from the Rabun County Mountains, from Roswell, from all over the state. We're glad you're with us. Go to the Facebook Live page on GPB, or go to the GPB News page on Facebook. You'll find us there. Let's get a break in.
You know, selling a car can be a hassle, but donating it is a whole different story. Let us take it off your hands or off your driveway and turn it into public radio and maybe even a tax deduction. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and here is how to donate.
Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
The conversation continues. You can hear it here during our break. You're listening to Political Rewind. We're joined today by Jim Galloway, our partner on Mondays and Fridays, Heath Garrett, Dr. Andra Gillespie, and Dr. Audrey Haynes, a first-timer from the University of Georgia. What do you think so far?
I'm getting schooled here. I am around some really talented people, and I am learning so much, especially you old-timers. I tell you what. I mean,
I think she's talking about you and me, Galloway.
Yeah, I know.
I want to point out we were in school together, right? Did you graduate UGA in 90?
Oh, you're being kind. 1987.
87. Okay. Well, maybe was your PA? I thought we were did a class together, maybe under Gene. I can't remember.
All right. Well,
grad school.
Yeah.
All right.
Sorry.
Jim, there's been some. All of a sudden, in the GOP governor's race, the Kemp-Cagle contest, we're seeing people release internal polling data. Now, all of us at this table know that campaigns, two things about campaigns. One, and Heath Garrett, the strategist, is the one we should mention about this. You don't release an internal poll for most reasons at all. You want to keep those numbers very quiet to yourself. So when you release numbers from an internal poll, you must have some motivation.
You're trying to explain yourself. You're trying to explain what you have done or what you are about to do. And that's what we're seeing on the Republican side specifically, but we're also seeing it on Abrams too.
Yeah.
Okay, with Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, who's in a runoff with Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle, he's got an internal poll that shows him surging, that he is in a statistical dead heat with Cagle in the July 24th primary runoff. And that's probably to be expected. I mean, I don't think that's quite unusual. Then you've got Cagle saying that he's got a smidgen more people than Kemp who say he would be the better Republican to face Stacey Abrams in November. So he is making, that's his excuse to make the I'm more electable argument.
Yeah, meanwhile, and then we'll open it up for everybody, Abrams put out some internal numbers done by Garin, research. They're pretty good, those guys over there, saying, giving a justification for the kind of campaign she wants to wage, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but also Andrew Gillespie saying that she herself is in a statistical dead heat in a matchup between either Cagle or Kemp.
So I'm not surprised by any of these numbers, and part of the reason why they look so different is it's really hard to identify who your universe is of primary voters and for the Republicans. And I would also sort of put with a grain of salt, a May survey is by no means going to be predictive of what a November election result is going to look like. So I care about the poll that comes out the week before the election and the weekend before the election more than I care about what happened the week after Memorial Day. That being said, with a much smaller sample size, I fielded my own survey right before the primary, and I didn't ask about the runoff between the Republican candidates. And when I was looking at sort of what the general election forecast would look at, I was primarily doing different types of permutations and doing a split between Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams to see sort of how they would pair up against all the candidates. So keep in mind, I have a smaller sample size, which means my confidence intervals are much bigger, which means it's somewhat imprecise. But basically, I kind of saw the same thing.
What does that mean? You saw what?
That she's, she was in dead heats with people.
Wow.
Stacey Evans, too. And so part of that's a function of the sample size. So I'm not surprised by, her showing up in the 40s, by any stretch of the imagination. But I also know that I don't care about May numbers. The only number that matters is the number that comes out after Election Day, and that there's probably going to be some shift and some movement, once the candidates have been decided on the Republican side, and then as this race really heats up.
Go ahead, Audrey.
Well, I was going to say, too, part of the research I do is often at the presidential level, but it still applies to what we're seeing in the gubernatorial election. When they send out these numbers, they're positioning and they're signaling. They're trying to signal to people that we're competitive.
Kemp would be the one in this instance, because he's the one who had to spend everything that he had to get into the runoff.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And he is trying to signal that he can win. And it's interesting to watch. And part of that is psychological. I mean, they're trying to get people to jump on the bandwagon, jump on their bandwagon. And personally, one of the things I think we're going to see with a runoff is it's going to be very divisive. And divisive primaries have a very negative effect if the party itself is somewhat fragmented. So if the Republican Party in the state is a bit more fragmented, it can have disastrous consequences in the general election. If they can come together and they're not fragmented and it's just two people beating each other up, but they both believe in the same thing and there's no underlying rift between fragments of the party, then they usually can recoup if they have enough time. And we'll see probably a very competitive election.
Heath, I thought, Jim started us off with a really good point that one of the reasons these internals were released was to give us an idea of how these candidates were going to run their races. We know that in the Peter Hart, Mark Garin poll that Stacey Abrams had, they identified for her as the top issue jobs for a diverse workforce. Well, I mean, that seems like a pretty good way to run a campaign. Let's more jobs for more people and get everybody out there working.
No, that's exactly right. These polls are obviously intended. They're driving messages now in the modern media context, whether it's digital or mainstream media. It guarantees articles that you don't get for other reasons in politics now. However, you need to take all these internal polls with a grain of salt. There's so much campaigning to be done in the next 8 weeks in the Republican primary runoff that the voters are going to move dramatically, I think, over that period of time, as you see $5 or $6 million spent on behalf of Casey Cagle, and you see $2 to $3 million spent on behalf of Brian Kemp. That is a snapshot. It doesn't surprise me they're going to close. You know, you got rid of five other candidates, so this is going to be a close race. But and then on the general election side, I do have a word of caution. Right, we've seen a trend here in Georgia for the last three election cycles. Democrats always poll better until the last 2 to 3 weeks of a general election.
Why do you think that is?
There are just theories out there because there's no good science on this. But, A, Republicans aren't picking up their phone as much. Number two, they're independent, not wanting to identify. But it's definitely clear that late breakers are breaking Republican. For whatever reason, they're not telling voters, they're saying they're undecided longer. We even saw that with Senator Isaacson. Like, this was an easy election where there really wasn't much of a threat. But with 2 weeks to go, he was at 48 and the Democrat was at 42.
Yeah,
and then
he
ends up winning with 56% of the vote.
This is what we were talking about Friday with Nate Silver and the inelasticity
right.
of the Georgia electorate.
Right.
The stickiness there.
Well, I think there are a couple of interesting points there. And so, you know, part of this is, you know, allowing people to identify as undecided as potentially forcing. And so people debate in terms of question wording about that. But at least as far as a primary is concerned, it is really difficult to identify who a likely voter is, which is why these things are imprecise. And then on top of that, couple non-response rates and all of those things that actually, you know, inject more uncertainty into the polls, on top of the fact that you talk to 500, 600, 800 people and then want to extrapolate that to hundreds of thousands, if not millions of voters. So I think people just need to understand that polls are blunt instruments. They try to put you in the ballpark with a range. You know, I've dealt with clients. So as a disclosure, I used to work for one of Garen Hart-Yang's competitors. You know, people flip out. Oh my gosh, your survey said 45 and this survey said 48%. And it's like, folks, that's the same thing.
Yeah, right?
And people just don't understand that people want polls to tell them more than they're actually designed to be able to do.
Let me ask you, let me direct this at you. The Stacey Abrams poll focuses on the economy, mm-hmm. which I think is kind of an invitation for her to really go after the Medicaid expansion issue, because there's a direct link to jobs of all sorts there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that issue something that you can be talked about or will be talked about in a GOP primary runoff?
Medicaid expansion?
Or whatever they prefer to call it, if they want to call it a waiver. I mean,
It is possible to be talked about, but it would not be a top five, top 10 issue for Republican primary voters in a runoff scenario like this. So it could be talked about.
But this is Abrams looking at a general.
But of course, she's going to be looking at it because her biggest weakness, right, when we have the number one state to do business in America and a great economy and historical unemployment, and the Democratic brand is so tarnished on job creation and on the economy and running it, she's got to address her greatest weakness. So I think that's why she's talking about it like this now.
So when I saw the memo, I was trying to imagine what the survey instrument looked like without having access to the survey instrument. And so, you know, you've got your vote questions, you've got your fave questions. That was from the message section. So they were basically trying out messages to figure out sort of which issues were important.
Right.
And so I suspected that it wasn't which is the most important issue to you question, but it was this battery where they said, we're going to talk about a couple of sort of like different messages. And they were looking to see what worked. And so this was the one that popped. And so it either got sort of the greatest, you know, number, you know, of votes, or the greatest proportion of votes, or they did something perhaps where they may have asked some questions kind of and tried to do an immediate pre and post test. And so, you know, we got to see sort of like whether or not there's any decay that goes along with that. But like when I saw that, I was like, oh, yeah, I've done stuff like that before or been instructed to do it on behalf of my former boss. So, you know, they were looking at a series of issues to see which ones people said were going to be most important to their vote. And that was the one that right now looks like it's working for her. So that's giving you a window in terms of the message that she's going to try to craft.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I called Peter Hart this morning and said, help us come on the show and help us understand this. And I'm hopeful we'll get him back. We'll get him here. No.
It's what? Proprietary, and so Stacey would have to, like, let that out. She probably is not.
Okay. Audrey, let's go back to the question of the issues that the polls, that they were being told by the campaigns, these polls have shown to be important to them. And the Kegel one is no surprise, that voters want experience, they want dependability, a reliable candidate, and they would postulate, obviously, that they're stable in a way that Brian Kemp isn't.
Right, because, in fact, I was talking with someone who worked on the Kegel campaign, asking them if they had come up with incompetent, and they said, no, but I like it, of course. Well, you know, that's what Kegel has done from the very beginning. This is a very kind of traditional presentation. I'm experienced, jobs. I'm Nathan Deal, too. Hopefully, you know, we want that consistency. Kemp is a big question. And my expectation is like what we saw with the stuff that came out, the Buckhead Boys and the negative attacks on Hill and Tippins, that we're going to see a lot more negative attacks on Kemp. Of course, there's plenty of money for it. And it will focus on his inexperience and probably his business record will be lambasted. And, you know, other issues that have gone on with the Secretary of State.
And if you think about what happened in the primary, right, Brian Kemp was the person that was not hit by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't.
Right.
There's a choice. There's a lot of opportunity for the Kegel campaign to start to define Brian Kemp in a way that nobody else attacked him. So these will be the first attacks on him that we've seen. And it'll be interesting to see what that does over the next couple of weeks to the voters.
But the rumor was that that was done on purpose because that was who they were hoping would be there.
Well, the Kegel people they wanted to run it. We're told wanted to run against Brian Kemp. But we talked about it on the show, Jim. We never did figure out why a Clay Tippins or a Hunter Hill didn't choose to really go after the guy who seemed to be moving up into the runoff spot, Brian Kemp.
Right. Well, there was a little bit of confusion over who that second guy was.
That's true.
That's right. And that was a strategic mistake, no question in hindsight.
All right. So speaking of all this about the Casey Cagle-Brian Kemp feud, and by the way, Jim, some people would argue that it is not the reliable, strong, experienced guy in Casey Cagle, that there are voters out there who want the disruptor. They want the Brian Kemp who is saying, and I just said that.
Right, right. And Kemp is clearly trying to position himself as kind of the recipient of a Trump endorsement.
Okay.
If that is ever going to come, I don't know if it's going to.
All right. That said, another story that we're looking at that was in the Insider today has to do with where this federal lawsuit, this lawsuit filed by a number of voter security groups coming together, challenging the security of the Georgia apparatus for voting, the touchscreen votes, and calling for Georgia to institute paper balloting for November. So a couple questions about this. Number one, is this the sort of issue that handled correctly could in fact hurt Brian Kemp? He's in charge of the election machinery.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a whole lot of discovery that can go on and testimony that can be offered that might color it if the case moves fast enough. And right now, since they're pressing for a decision before November, obviously there's going to be something along those lines. The judge is Federal District Judge Amy Totenberg, which should be a familiar name to NPR listeners.
She's Nina's sister.
Right. But what I find interesting, really interesting in there, is the way that this is playing out in the race for Secretary of State. You've got Democrat John Barrow, who's the nominee for this office, saying that he would, if elected, he would decertify 7,000 state voting machines, which would force the legislature to act on this issue and install some sort of system of paper ballots. That's a fairly aggressive approach right there. Raffensperger, I don't know that he's taken a position on it, and David Belisle, who's the other Republican in the runoff, says he wouldn't be that aggressive on the issue.
I just think there's an interesting coalition of the right and the left coming together to demand paper ballots in this case for security. And I think it goes to the greater societal distrust of technology and privacy, right? Which if you're seeing every night about cyber threats and cyber hacking and cyber security, why wouldn't you not be suspect about this? And I think it's going to confuse our kind of electoral politics. And it may be a bipartisan issue by the time we get to November.
I mean, I think this has a lot to do with distrust. I'm always interested in sort of the empirics of whether or not you can actually prove that one is safer than the other. I looked up an old paper by our colleague Charles Stewart at MIT, who's an Emory undergrad alum, and basically there really isn't a difference between electronic voting and paper ballots in terms of like residual voting rates, so whether or not people are likely to mess up on a ballot. He has done some work about whether or not people on electronic ballots are more likely to stand in line longer and other types of things. So I think this really kind of comes down to preference and sort of what people's comfort level and security is in terms of thinking about this. And so this is why this is more of a kind of political debate as opposed to a real empirical debate.
Well, it may very well be, but if the voter security groups win in a federal court, Georgia may be faced with a very sudden need to come up with an alternative system of voting by November. Now, it's happened. I'm going to forget whether it's Virginia. We just had a state that was ordered by the feds very late in the game to go to paper ballots, and they were able to do it successfully. And I'll look up who it was. But, I mean, this is going to put an enormous strain on the system if those groups win this lawsuit.
Well, I would guess that it's highly likely that, you know, we'll see it extended. I'm not sure that there will be a full-out win. But
so there might be, if nothing else, a stay of the order, for instance, through November.
I don't see a judge interfering in that. And moreover, if that decision were to come down, what does Brian Kemp do?
Well,
that would put him in a terrifically difficult position.
All right, I am getting both Tom Faust and our engineer Tyler Morris are frantically signaling that I'd better get another break in. By the way, as I do it, I asked Marionette Allen Audifren to tell us what she meant by her saying the line will keep moving, and she had a good answer. She says, what if Indian restaurant based on religious beliefs doesn't want to serve Christians or a non-Hindu? So she's extrapolating this in a much broader way. Who knows how that might come down? So keep sending us notes on Facebook Live or at Politics GPB. Let's go to a break.
On the next Fresh Air, Keith Hernandez. He played on World Series teams with the Cardinals and Mets and made a memorable appearance on Seinfeld. His new memoir is about learning baseball. When he was a kid, his father made a contraption in his garage to practice hitting.
I was there taking probably 500 to 1,000 swings a day. I just absolutely loved it.
But success, he says, didn't come easy. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Okay, we stay away often from Trump land, largely because I understand how addicted people are to their cable news preference. If you're watching MSNBC or Fox or CNN, wherever you watch, you get it all the time. But I do think every now and then it's great to go around and hear how all of you on this panel, especially a smart panel like this one, what do we make? Let me start with you, Audrey. What do we make of the release of this 20-page letter that came from the Trump legal team to the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, essentially asserting a variety of rights that the president has, including the suggestion that a sitting president cannot be indicted, and then a President Trump saying, I could... And that the president does have full rights for pardon of any of the people, including himself. And then we have Rudolph Giuliani on the Sunday show saying, you know, the president could shoot James Comey, his FBI director, and couldn't be indicted. What's happening here?
James Madison is rolling over in his grave. How about that? After looking at that, I think I'm uniquely qualified to answer this question in that I do teach a class on political propaganda. And a lot of what this letter is and this memo is really not meant for consumption of any true legal critique. It's really meant to, send out that volley to the public, the court of public opinion, and sort of inoculate or plant these seeds of ideas that this is okay. And you can go off to your group and start talking about how it is okay for the president to pardon himself, when really, if you think about it, for any moment, it's in many ways, it's just a ludicrous idea that the president could do anything they wanted to in our system of checks and balances justice, that would be okay.
I should point out that, in fact, the president himself tweeted this morning that he has the right to pardon himself, but since he's done nothing wrong, he won't need to. But Andra, a lot of the people who watched this unfold, saw the letter, saw the interviews over the weekend, were mostly focused not on the silly comment by Rudolph Giuliani, really. Well, you don't think it was silly, but put it this way, it was ludicrous, was it not?
Well, it's not ludicrous or unheard of, considering that President Trump said as a candidate he could shoot people on Fifth Avenue and people would still vote for him.
Okay, but
so it fits that kind of the legal
argument is not absolutely ludicrous here.
Wait, is it a first? I get that. We'll get to it. Yeah. Is it a distraction from the bigger point, which was the repetition of the fact that the president has the right to pardon at will? Was that a message to Manafort, to all of the people out there who may be exposed and vulnerable to a special counsel who says turn state's evidence, essentially?
So, I mean, I think that message is out there. I think the pardons issued last week, sent that message potentially to people. And this is up for debate. I don't think people are questioning the president's right to pardon, but people are questioning whether or not that is evidence of some larger type of nefarious action. And I think all this shows is that our institutions have relied on norms for so long. And then when you have somebody who is willing to flout every norm in the book, how then do we respond to that? And we don't really know that. We've got to figure out whether or not we rise to the occasion.
Well, except that the Clinton people claimed that the president had certain exemptions.
Yeah, I was going to say, we've been through this before.
Okay,
it was the 1990s.
I interrupted you.
No, this is a good point. And I think that we've got to be careful here, right? If you're going to talk about checks and balances, the reason why, if there is a legal standing for the argument that the lawyers have made, put the president and his tweets aside for a minute, it is checks and balances. At the formation of our country, we had people dueling and shooting each other over these executive branch versus legislative branch versus judicial branch. The idea that he can pardon himself is because legislatures would have used lawyers to constantly indict and be going after the executive branch. The executive branch would be doing that against the legislative branch. There is a separation of powers argument here. The way to remove a president, if you don't like what he's done, is the impeachment process in the Constitution. They are broadly interpreting that, so don't read into what I'm saying here. I've not gone back and looked at the case law here, but the reason why we do this is we're moving towards a point in this country, at the state level and at the federal level, where we're constantly threatening to indict the other branch of government. And the founding fathers actually thought that through and thought, you cannot have a functioning government if every other group can indict every other group in government, because we all think that the other person is doing something illegal all of the time. And some of these same arguments were made in the 90s during the Clinton, and the Republican legislature went through the impeachment process and failed.
Right. But the prosecution of Bill Clinton in the 1990s did result in his forced testimony, number one.
That's right.
That's a strike against the Trump argument. We've already had a president in my lifetime assert that because the president does it, it can't be wrong. And that was Mr. Nixon, and he was rejected. I think
I'm not defending his tweets here.
I think we're on pretty treacherous ground here, and you have to wonder where the line is. I would say one thing about this letter, Bill, was that it did confess that Trump, that President Trump dictated that letter about the Russian meeting.
On Air Force One, trying to explain why Donald Trump Jr. took that meeting.
I mean, I think this is a really interesting throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think we're used to thinking about that as look to see what argument works. But I think what the Trump team is doing is they're just throwing everything at the wall to just kind of like muddy it up and confuse everybody so that they can then do whatever it is that they want to do in the first place. And so, you know, I just think that this is a time for citizens to be vigilant. I think it is a time for the co-equal branches to assert their power and to provide those checks and balances. And for us to realize that, yeah, lots of things operate by norm here, but those norms only work when everybody is playing their part.
Absolutely. But I also think very quickly now, because we're starting to run out of time, you know, the Heath makes a good point. The anti-Trumpers out there see everything he's doing as egregious. But maybe we do have to take a deep breath and say, no, we did go through this under President Clinton, who did attack Kenneth Starr over and over again, try to undermine the credibility. So while Trump's behavior, many people would say, has been unbelievably egregious, he'd crossed every norm that we know. He's just done it in a more blatant way and in a way that calls attention to itself in a way that the Clinton folks didn't, I think. Fair enough?
Well, I would agree somewhat, but I would say let the process, you know, go through the process. I mean, just like it happened with Clinton, who, you know, I would not defend. And just as there are issues with Trump, you know, part of the problem is muddying the waters and using the court of public opinion does more to disrupt the way politics should work in the positive way, you know, and flouting those norms really has a destructive impact.
And that has been the case. I mean, I am not trying to underplay Andra, Audrey, the extent to which the Trump White House has undermined norms. I mean, I don't mean that at all, but I just want to get a little balance from what was going on in previous administrations. Mm-hmm. We're out of time for today's show. You know, Heath, I was worried for a minute when you started talking about duels among the founding fathers. You were going to ruin the end of Hamilton for Jim Gallagher. Do not tell him. Do not tell him what happens at the end of Hamilton.
That was a Hamiltonian reference.
Dr. Andra Gillespie, Heath Garrett, Dr. Audrey Haynes, it was really a pleasure to have you all here today. Thank you for weighing in on these really interesting subjects. Jim Galloway, you're going to be back on Wednesday, which I'm thrilled about. You and Bluestein will be here together. And we have another one of our Sam Olin's Michael Thurman shows. And those are always so interesting.
Absolutely. Good pairing right there.
All right. So we'll see everybody for the Wednesday show. And then again, on Thursday, Tom Faust and Tyler Morris and I are heading down to Columbus, where we're looking forward to doing our show in front of all of you on Thursday night at the River Center. Calvin Smyre will be there. Josh McCoon will be there. Mayor Teresa Tomlinson will be on hand. It ought to be really, really fun. So come on out and see us Thursday night at the River Center. That's it for us. See you again on Wednesday.